This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across the state. Today we're going to begin our show, as we have so many times in the past year or so. We're going to talk about the pandemic. We've heard about it from the perspective of lots of people affected by it. But we're going to hear today from Dr. Donald Warren. We've talked to him before, and he has a unique perspective on it because he's a public health expert. Dr. Donald Warren is the director of the Public Health Program and the Indigenous Health Program at the University of North Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Warren.
You're welcome. Very happy to be here.
Give us your current assessment of the pandemic in North Dakota.
Well, when we look at the numbers, it really has been quite devastating. In terms of the total number of cases that have been diagnosed, we're at nearly 100,000. Latest numbers that I've seen is over 95,000 cases of COVID-19 in the state of North Dakota. So when we think about our population being maybe around 800,000 people, we can see that we're well over more than 1 in 10 people who have been confirmed to have COVID-19. Now, the actual prevalence is even higher because we know that there are many people who get COVID-19 but just never did get tested for it, so they're not in the documented cases. So there's been a significant number of cases already in the state of North Dakota. And unfortunately, we're also approaching 1,400 deaths, 1,400. And to put that in perspective, that really over a 12-month period makes it the leading cause of death. I mean, this is numbers that are worse than a typical year for things like heart disease or cancer or diabetes. And when we think of, for example, the amount of resources we put into diabetes awareness and diabetes prevention, the mortality rate from COVID-19 is much worse than that. So from a public health perspective, this really has been pervasive and devastating.
You mentioned the testing that's been done out there. I noticed in the last week I saw a number for antigen testing. So that's testing people who may have had a case of COVID and not known it. Isn't that what you're finding?
Yeah, so COVID-19 is a very interesting infection because for some people, obviously, it's debilitating and even can cause death. And then for others, they have very mild symptoms and might not even be cognizant that they had been exposed to the virus. So we will learn more over the years in terms of, you know, what are those predisposing factors or what are the factors even for particular individuals that might be at higher risk for a severe case of the illness as compared to more of a mild case. But yeah, we do know that there are many more people who have been infected with COVID-19 than we have in terms of documented cases.
You mentioned that 100,000 cases have been found, positive cases. That's about 15% of the state's population. When do you think we'll have enough positive cases and, for that matter, enough vaccine in people's arms to reach herd immunity?
Yeah, so for herd immunity, and I'm sure most of your audience knows this, but for those who don't, that's when we have enough people who are immune, either through prior infection or through immunization, such that it doesn't create the same type of public health concern in terms of high risk for spread of the disease. And World Health Organization recommends that we should be at about 95%.
Wow.
Either immunized or having prior infection, really to reach herd immunity. So we still have a long way to go. And herd immunity, I think a lot of people think of that in negative terms, you know, that we're trying to make sure everybody gets infected. And actually, herd immunity is a good thing if it's accomplished through vaccination. So we have herd immunity from measles, for example, because of high rates of vaccination. But you can get herd immunity through high rates of infection. But as you know, we mentioned, with about 15% of the population with infection, that's 1,400 deaths. And I don't think that's acceptable to any of us to have that high of a death rate to try to achieve herd immunity.
We've been hearing about some stumbles in the efforts nationwide to get the vaccine into people. In North Dakota, it appears to be better. I'm seeing numbers at around 50,000-plus doses that have been given to the state and more than 40,000 that have been administered. What's your assessment?
Yeah, based on the numbers that I've seen, now, I'm not a frontline health worker, you know, in the clinics or in the sectors where we're actually providing the immunizations, but the data that I see reflects what you're saying, is that it does appear that we are actually getting the immunizations administered. It's more than just having them in the freezer or in the state. You know, we actually have to utilize them. And unfortunately, nationally, it seems like there's been relatively low utilization of the vaccine that we have available to us. And I think there just has been, in many areas of the nation, a lack of a coordinated effort and plan to ensure that we actually administer the vaccinations. But I think in North Dakota, we're doing a little bit better job than most states.
The Centers for Disease Control says a faster spreading variant of COVID-19 that showed up in London in the UK will be the dominant COVID source in the U.S. by March. Should we be concerned about that?
Yeah, so we should be concerned from the perspective that it's more easily transmissible from one person to another. But still, by having the public health measures like wearing a mask and having the physical distancing and washing hands and all of those measures that we've been talking about for months, we still should be able to slow the spread of this new variant. I guess if there's any good news with the new variant, it appears that this variant coming out of the UK is not necessarily a more severe illness. It's just more easily spread. At least that's what the preliminary data show. So more people could get COVID, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a deadlier form of the virus. However, we still know that there's a significant mortality rate. So as it spreads more quickly, that also means that it could lead to higher rates of death overall, but not necessarily within the people who have had COVID. What's very concerning is that there's other variants from other parts of the world that do appear to have other types of changes. So I'm sure people have seen the picture of the virus, kind of the blue sphere with the red nodules kind of sticking out of it. And it's those surface proteins that are kind of what it adheres to the human tissues. And what it appears is that some of the new variants, those spike proteins or those little red nodules that you see in the picture, if those are altered, that actually is the target for some of the antibody therapies as well as some of the vaccinations. So it is possible that other variants, not necessarily the UK variant, but others might lead to challenges in the effectiveness of some of the therapies that we have. So I think that over time, we're just going to have to continue to be vigilant. And this first wave of immunizations is absolutely necessary, and we need as many people to participate as possible to get to that herd immunity point. But also understanding that in the future, it could change. There could be variations of the virus that lead to additional efforts to try to get it under control.
Dr. Donald Warren is the director of the Public Health and Indigenous Health Programs at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Warren, just following up on that, because of the possibility of variants of COVID, like there are variants of flu or strains of flu, is it possible that we'll get annual COVID vaccinations as well as flu shots at some point?
Yeah, that certainly is a possibility. And it's not necessarily a bad thing that we already do this for influenza. So influenza, of course, is also a virus. And one thing that we have in our advantage, we tend to see some of these respiratory viruses really spike primarily during the colder months. But, of course, in the southern hemisphere, when it is winter here, it is summer there and vice versa. So the way we track influenza in the northern hemisphere, like here in the U.S., we track what's happening in the southern hemisphere, places like Australia. And in our summer months, it's their winter time, and we can get a better feel for what are the variants or strains of the virus that are more prevalent in a given year. And then we develop the vaccines to target those variants that are of higher prevalence. So it's quite possible we might have a similar pattern for coronavirus vaccinations in the same way that we do for influenza vaccinations. But I don't think that should create any fear or concern, because we have all kinds of new vaccines that are available that are actually doing very good and meaningful things from a public health perspective. Even, you know, vaccines for things like shingles or vaccines for HPV and preventing certain types of cancer. So it's possible that we just might have the need for annual coronavirus vaccinations as well.
This past year was strange in a way, in the way that the global health emergency converged in lots of ways with politics. Do you expect any significant changes in the federal response to the pandemic with the start of this new Joe Biden, Kamala Harris administration?
I do. And without getting overly political regarding it, just quite honestly, in looking at the teams of health professionals that are being put in place by the Biden administration, it gives me a great deal of confidence that we will be focused on the best of public health science and public health practice, and very good administrators that understand how to do population health effectively. So I'm encouraged by the new administration and the proposed leaders in public health. With the previous administration, there were medical advisors advising on COVID policy who had no background in infectious disease, no background in public health, yet they were some of the louder voices in the room. And anytime we have politics interfering with public health science, then we're setting ourselves up for some bad outcomes. So I feel encouraged that things will improve this year.
Well, let me bring you to the North Dakota legislature, which is in session and which is dealing with all kinds of bills, including a couple that relate to what we just spoke about. There's a bill that's been proposed in the legislature to ban mask mandates. And there's another one that would disallow cities to respond with more restrictive rules than the state. Again, this is political, but this is also public health.
Yeah, and, you know, and just as a side note, you know, when I went into public health, my interest in promoting the health of populations and trying to achieve equity in health across populations, I didn't realize it would have to be such a politically charged and politically motivated topic area, but that's what it is. And I think that from one perspective, if there is the preference on behalf of a local community to take steps that are supported by public health science to protect the health of their community members, I feel like it's really not a conservative principle to limit the local community's choices in that way. So I really don't think that those types of proposed bills or perspectives at the state level, those are not rooted in public health science. Those are rooted in political science.
Okay.
Really, the political perspectives, and it's remarkable to me that we have, you know, 15% of the state that's already been infected, approaching 1,500 North Dakotans who have died. Yet we're still allowing politics to drive much of this decision-making. And this is not, again, it's not rooted in science or data. It's rooted in other types of socio-political perspectives.
Recently on the Connecticut Public Health Center's Conversations on Healthcare, hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter spoke to you about your area of expertise, which is American Indian health policies. Let's talk about, in a nutshell, what you were telling them and what you should be telling our listeners about indigenous health in a pandemic and how some populations are more vulnerable than others.
Yeah, so we can look at this from a number of perspectives, one from a social determinants of health perspective, but then also from a health policy perspective. From a social determinants perspective, some of the things that make people at higher risk for infectious disease like COVID-19 include things like poverty, inadequate nutrition, overcrowded housing. Those types of things put people at higher risk for communicable diseases. And then just look at the challenges with things like overcrowded housing, and how do we then effectively quarantine if we have multiple people living in a small dwelling? How do we isolate people who test positive for something like COVID-19? So then the challenges are that the incidence or the new cases of COVID-19 go up because of those social dynamics. In addition to that, populations that have higher burden of chronic disease like diabetes, heart disease, or lung disease are also at greater risk for hospitalization and death due to COVID-19. So it's all those socioeconomic factors that lead some populations, particularly in North Dakota, American Indian populations, at higher risk for getting COVID-19, but then also at higher risk for hospitalization and dying from COVID-19. And that's what's been borne out by the data. We do have higher rates of infection and higher rates of mortality, unfortunately. But on the policy side, kind of little known fact, and I don't know why it's a little known fact, but it is, but American Indians are actually the only population in this country that is born with a legal right to health services. And that's based on treaties in which we exchanged vast amounts of land, including the vast amount of North Dakota, for various social services like housing, education, and health care. So that's why we have a Bureau of Indian Affairs, a Bureau of Indian Education, and that's why we have an Indian Health Service. It's really a treaty right to those services. And Indian Health Service is not free health care. When you look at the vast amount of resources that were exchanged for those services, I look at IHS as the largest prepaid health plan in history. Unfortunately, the Congress has just never funded Indian Health Service at a level that is needed to provide adequate services. So it's a population that is vulnerable in terms of social determinants of health, but our health system has been inadequate to mount the type of response needed to prevent the bad outcome.
The Indigenous Health Program has relations with the state's native tribes. Is there a collaborative effort underway to kind of analyze how the pandemic has stressed the Indian Health Service, or for that matter, instruct how maybe better to confront a threat like this in the future?
Yeah, so there are a lot of groups that are looking at the different aspects of health services research and health policy research. Specifically at UND, we're also involved in trying to understand the actual prevalence of the disease, the seroprevalence of COVID-19, because as we had mentioned earlier, we know the numbers of documented cases, but we don't know the numbers of undocumented cases. So if we can do some of the antigen testing and antibody, actually looking at people who have antibodies toward COVID-19, get a better feel for the real numbers of infection. And it's our hypothesis, and I think the preliminary data bear it out, is that the rates of disease are worse in rural impoverished communities with overcrowded housing. And of course, in North Dakota, the tribal nations experience a lot of those dynamics. So there are efforts to get a better understanding of the dynamics leading to higher rates of infection, but also what are the policy issues that could be put forth to try to prevent something like this in the future.
There have been concerns voiced in many corners of the world and in our country about these so-called long-haul cases and some of these complications that don't seem like, a lung disease or whatever, that could become pre-existing conditions, systems of the body that are affected by COVID-19 that seem surprising.
Yeah, and with it being relatively new, I mean, we've had coronavirus for, documented for many, many decades. We've known about coronavirus as causing things like upper respiratory infections, but this particular variant causing the COVID-19 disease is just much more virulent or more powerful. So with it being relatively new, we also don't have long-term data, but there are some preliminary data and information showing us that for some people, there are long-term bad outcomes, and it can affect more than just the lungs. So over time, we will learn more, but obviously we just haven't had the years of follow-up to track this. And, for a response to a virus, of course, it's the body's immune system that can attack the virus and try to get rid of it. But in that immune response, we can have all kinds of types of responses. One thing's called a cytokine storm, which is basically overwhelming immune response that can actually cause damage to the healthy parts of the body too, not just to the virus. So we'll learn a lot more over the years in terms of what are either the genetic factors or environmental factors that cause these terrible outcomes in some individuals but not in others.
Well, we've learned the hard way that a viral outbreak in a city in China can have international implications. We also learned that in the space of a relatively short amount of time, vaccines can be developed or were developed that are very promising. Should there be a focused international effort to improve the development of vaccines, something we're all pitching in and keeping on, you know, in front of all this stuff to respond to new viral threats?
Yeah, I think for those of us who are looking for silver linings within the pandemic, I think the rapid nature by which these vaccines were developed really is an incredible accomplishment. So I think that what we have now is a case study in how we could mobilize international resources to address a public health crisis. And perhaps if we can see some calming down of the political firestorm that seems to be going on in many parts of the country and across the globe, if we can get past those dynamics, perhaps we have a case study and a mechanism to promote more international collaboration to promote public health. That's what I'm really hoping we see come out of this. But I think just with the very rapid development of effective vaccines, this really is a case study in how we can do things collaboratively on the international stage.
I noted in a recent publication from UND that the University School of Medicine and Health Sciences is looking at its curriculum. What kind of changes are under consideration?
Well, we're already in process of implementing some changes. So nationally, there has been a trend toward shortening the amount of preclinical education and expanding the clinical education. So when I went to medical school, I started medical school in 1990, so 31 years ago. Literally the last millennium is when I went to medical school. We had 2 years of preclinical training, so basic sciences, and then 2 years of clinical training, actually working with patients in the hospitals and in the clinics. And what we have found is that for effective physicians, of course, we need a good understanding of basic science, but even more important than that, we need to have good clinical training. So the trend nationally has been to shorten the preclinical training to less than 2 years and expand the clinical training to beyond 2 years. So we're basically following the national trend in that direction. And instead of having 2 full years of preclinical basic sciences, that is shortened to 1.5 years. So we're calling the longer-term outcome is curriculum 2.0, and we're transitioning now, so we're kind of in curriculum 1.5. So the goal is to expand clinical training in medical school and then really shorten but also be more efficient with that use of time of that 1.5 years of preclinical training.
Well, it reminds me of what's happening in a lot of education programs that would-be teachers are getting into classrooms earlier to get what that experience is like before they graduate. It looks like these lessons are being learned in broadly across many disciplines. Dr. Donald Warren is the director of the Public Health Program and the Indigenous Health Program at the University of North Dakota. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up on Main Street, Sarah Elmquist-Squires talks about her new job as Executive Director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state of North Dakota and the North Dakota Medical Association are encouraging people who have tested positive for COVID-19 and are at high risk for serious complications to look at whether new treatment options, such as monoclonal antibodies, are right for them.
With these new antibodies, it's really allowed us to take the fight to COVID and hopefully keep people out of the hospital and keep people having severe complications from the disease.
Dr. Joshua Ranum is the vice president of the NDMA. He says this is an outpatient infusion treatment, and Ranum says it would work best if it's given early on after the diagnosis.
Nearly everyone has reported that they felt noticeably better the next day. Not perfect, but noticeably better. These are really incredibly well-tolerated medications, and if given early, can be significantly effective in reducing severity of illness and hospitalization.
One of the people who's had the treatment is Grand Forks State Senator Ray Holmberg, who tested positive for COVID-19 last fall.
Within 2 hours, my doctor called me and recommended that we go down the road of this plasma infusion.
Holmberg says within 36 hours he was receiving the infusion. And how did it work?
For a few hours, it was interesting. The only time I had a fever was just right after I received that. And within 2 days, all of the symptoms that I had, which was mostly just extreme tiredness, they were gone. And the only thing that lasted was a loss of taste for probably a month.
Holmberg says he would encourage people who are offered the option by their doctor to go through the treatment. A legislative committee is looking at a bill to eliminate bails and arrest warrants for low-level offenders, those who commit Class C felonies or misdemeanors. Supporters of the bill say some of the people who are accused of those lower-level crimes often can't come up with the money to post bail and therefore have to sit in jail. Travis Fink is the executive director of the North Dakota Commission on Legal Counsel for Indigents.
I have seen people plead guilty simply to get out of jail. That should shake every single person to their core when we talk about constitutional values. No one should plead guilty because they don't have the money to post a cash bail.
But representatives of law enforcement told the House Judiciary Committee they worry that if there is no bail, people will skip out of appearing in court, flee across the state lines. Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner.
Well, remember, this person made the decision to break the law. Okay, they're the ones that did that. They need to be held accountable initially. And we need to start looking out for victims. That piece has been forgotten in this whole thing. And as the sheriff of Cass County, I feel we need to stick up for our victims.
The committee did not take immediate action on the bill. Johnner and Fargo Police Chief David Zabolski said they would be willing to sit down with the sponsors of the bill and work compromise language. And North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer thinks that with the possibility of President Trump facing a post-presidential impeachment trial, the U.S. Supreme Court should weigh in on whether the action is even constitutional. Cramer made the comment in an interview with KVRR in Fargo.
Get an advisory opinion and see if we can't avoid even doing this in the Senate. That would be my preference. And I think that'd be much better in terms of getting America more toward healing and less toward driving the wedge deeper between people.
Cramer says he thinks Trump lost the election because of many reasons, including the pandemic, his communication style, and his poor performance during his first debate with Joe Biden. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
After a turbulent transition of power, Joe Biden now inherits many challenges in a divided nation. He's set to be inaugurated on the same stage where rioters overtook the Capitol. I'm Rachel Martin. Join NPR Wednesday for special live coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.
Listen to NPR's live inauguration coverage Wednesday beginning at 10 a.m. Central right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Sarah Elmquist-Squires. She is the new executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. She took over in December, and she joins us by phone. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're taking over for Steve Andrist. He's from a longtime North Dakota newspaper family. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I have worked at several newspapers in Minnesota. I started my career in western Minnesota at the Pope County Tribune in Glenwood, and I worked for a couple of weekly newspapers in west central Minnesota, and spent the last nearly 15 years at the Winona Post in Winona, Minnesota. That is a twice weekly free newspaper. And I kind of rose in the ranks from reporter to editor there. So that's my background in newspapers.
Why did you want the job of executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association?
Well, I really see this role as doing a number of things. First and foremost, we, work to assist our state newspapers in a variety of different ways. And I think today that kind of collaboration is really crucial for all of us. We also do lobbying work that supports the First Amendment and government transparency, which I find to be fascinating and truly important during these times. And so What really attracted me was the opportunity to work collaboratively with, more newspapers and hopefully really assist in their success during what has turned out to be a stressful time for the press.
As I mentioned, you're taking over for Steve Andrus. We've had him on our show a couple of times, as a matter of fact. Have you discussed the job with him?
Oh, sure. I was, really fortunate to have my first pretty much month on the job to be working hand in hand with Steve and really showing me the ropes and also, discussing the future of North Dakota newspapers and what we can do to, help really innovate and collaborate in ways to be successful together. So I was really just so pleased to have the time to spend with him in discussing those things. And he's been gracious enough to be available to me even in his retirement, because I definitely have plenty of questions and I'm grateful to have his help going forward too.
What's your plan to acquaint yourself with your membership?
Well, it's a challenging time to be getting to meet people from a distance in a lot of instances, but I'm looking forward to a time when it's a little more safe to be getting together in person, and I'm hoping to spend some time this summer traveling around the state and really getting to know not only my newspaper colleagues, but also the communities that they work within and represent and document, and really kind of befriend every corner of North Dakota as I travel around and do that.
Newspapers have been under considerable stress for many years. You referred to that. What can you and your association do to keep North Dakota's newspaper industry from further erosion?
Well, I think really the key to a successful future for newspapers is something that we've all kind of started to do and really need to focus more on going forward, and that is working together collaboratively in ways that benefit us all. And so I think years ago, we used to have more of a friendly rivalry among newspapers, and we all still enjoy being the first one to get the scoop. But I think there are plenty of ways that we can team up together and share resources and kind of lighten the burden of doing it alone. One of the things that we have underway now that I think is an example of that is we have an internship program that is run through a grant from the North Dakota Newspaper Association Education Foundation. That includes three legislative interns who are right now at the Capitol, busy at work, covering the session as it gets underway this week. And what they do is, as they work on stories of statewide interest that have to do with state government and the session, and provide stories and photos to all of our member newspapers. So that's a way that newspapers don't necessarily have to invest as much time in sending individual staff members to the Capitol to do that work, and they can take advantage of that resource and then focus their energies and their budgets more so on covering the news at home and be a little less stretched, a little less thin.
Are you considering then newspapers perhaps sharing bylines or investing as a group in a particular kind of reporting expertise?
Sure. I think that newspapers are at times, already doing some of that. You see newspapers under more common ownership these days, and so they are sharing stories and sharing reporters and bylines. And one of the other things that we've been exploring too, and it's still in its infancy, is the potential for a nonprofit news co-op that could, potentially provide more of those statewide and local story resources for papers. so that collectively we can ensure that our content is really, you know, covering all the bases, and then individual papers can, you know, focus their resources on the things that can't be replicated, you know, and the unique news that happens in all of our towns and cities. So while we have, lost a few newspapers in the past, I think that a lot of papers have kind of expanded their coverage, and we work really hard to make sure that we don't have, you know, gaps in our state where they don't have a newspaper who's interested in their city government and their local school districts, because we know that those are what can be most important to communities and to folks' everyday lives. And so we have a really good representation across the map of North Dakota, and that's something that we work really hard to continue and look to the future to provide.
Sarah Elmquist Squires is the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. She took over in the 1st of December. Sarah, let's talk about some of these smaller weekly newspapers and local journalism at that level. Small town papers sometimes struggle not to become the center of attention about news. They may not cast a positive light on the community. And, of course, advertisers have a lot of leverage in that environment as well. What kind of advice or help can you offer to people who might be facing that kind of dilemma?
Well, you know, I think a motto that I adopted years ago that I think applies to a lot of tough situations is that you can't address or fix a problem until you acknowledge that you have it. And so our communities, you know, often face news that is difficult and maybe doesn't reflect real positively. But, you know, it's our duty to shine a light on our troubles, and that's the first step into a path toward addressing them and fixing them and improving. And I think as well that, you know, newspapers are first and foremost providing a service to our readers, and who are, you know, essentially taxpayers. So we want to make sure that we're being a watchdog when it comes to, state and local government and tackling those problems and issues. And, you know, maybe that first story or that first headline might be a bitter pill to swallow, but I think, you know, that is the first chapter, and we all kind of look forward to addressing problems in our community and getting to those final stories that show the journey that we've taken to address them and make improvements to our communities too.
How can you help newspapers adapt to the social media phenomenon where people basically seek out reflections of their own opinions and attitudes and interests in news? I know the Forum, for example, which only publishes twice a week now, but publishes a daily e-paper, has a very active online presence that's updated all the time throughout the day. The e-paper just once, obviously, and the physical paper Wednesday and Saturday. But all of these papers out there across the state are dealing with readers who have access to other sources of information, even about their own town. How do you give them a leg up in that competitive environment?
It's really changed the landscape of how people consume news and how they kind of determine, you know, what sources that they should trust as they seek that out. And in a lot of ways, it's really complicated some of the work that we do, but it has also made it all that more important. So I think maybe some of the things that are lacking as far as these new media and in particular social media is the blur of the line between, you know, the news side of things and the opinion side of things.
Yes.
And I think where folks start to stumble is not being able to easily distinguish those things. So I think that's where newspapers can provide a much easier way to distinguish, essentially fact from opinion. And of course, that's because we put those on separate pages for folks. When it comes to our participation online and social media, you know, that's something that, that individual newspapers have been working on and developing for years now. And some like the Forum are much more active online and are have become, you know, in some ways participating in that and in the ways that people consume news via social media and online. And others, I think, are more traditional print newspapers. And that's kind of a place where folks can take what they've looked at throughout the week online and maybe wondered if what they're seeing is the truth or not or what. And then they turn to their local paper and they can find out more and from a source that they know that they can trust. And so, you know, regardless of whether we're real frequent flyers ourselves as newspapers on social media, I think we're all really looking to social media to find those questions that people have and to find where folks might be being misled so that we can translate some of those confusing issues for them in our papers.
So using social media as a resource, in a sense.
Sure. I think especially, you know, in terms of the pandemic and how we approach covering that in the newspaper, I think that we've really found that we've had to translate a lot of, you know, basic and national news for our readers and cover some of the more, you know, basic and broad-reaching aspects of COVID-19 because we do serve as that home base at a time when news online can be very confusing and conflicted. And so I think, you know, we kind of, you know, that really demonstrates the way that we've become that touchstone and that pillar for folks, you know, when they turn away from their computer screen or their cell phone, kind of wondering, you know, what to make of these conflicting reports that were there for them to turn to say, okay, well, this is what's true and this is what I can rely on and go from there. So, you know, as newspapers are certainly looking at social media and leaning on those patterns and how folks are getting their information to, you know, figure out how we need to digest that and show them, you know, what the news really is and what they need to know today.
When I was a kid, the Minneapolis papers and the Forum both had morning and afternoon editions. Of course, mm-hmm. That's changed. The cost of newsprint and, you know, the ink, the physical material to get a paper out has become more of an overhead issue. And now postal rates are likely to increase and further create a profit margin issue for newspapers that are mailing out editions. What are you telling members, or what will you be telling members about how to prepare for what the inevitable changes that continue to happen?
The issue with the U.S. Postal Service has been evolving and kind of looming for many years for us. And, you know, we do have a lot of newspapers who rely on the Postal Service either wholly for their delivery needs or for their delivery needs that are maybe further outside of their local area. So, you know, we work closely with our National Newspaper Association industry lobbyists who are following what's happening with the Postal Service quite closely. And while we really hope that Congress comes up with a solution that would fund the Postal Service's future liabilities and really decrease that pressure for major rate increases, we recognize that there is likely to be some costs that go up here in the near term. So we're working, you know, on a lot of different levels to address that and help our members navigate those changes. And that can mean a lot of different approaches, you know, depending on what your newspaper operation is and how heavily you rely on the Postal Service. But we've got newspapers who are, you know, teaming up with neighboring newspapers to co-op some delivery together. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to, you know, lessen the reliance on the Postal Service, you know, if it indeed becomes, you know, less cost effective to do so. So I think there's a lot of different ways to approach that. And we're really hopeful that Congress takes a real hard look at how or what the future of USPS truly is, because I think we could see some pretty dramatic increases in postal rates, and the future of the Postal Service would still be in jeopardy for a variety of reasons. So we're hoping that that is an issue that that is looked at seriously at the federal level, because, you know, it's not just newspapers who rely on the post office to, you know, get their business done. I think many businesses and industries and just regular families and folks need that service to continue in a way that's economically feasible.
You mentioned newspapers collaborating more and improving their efficiency that way. What about those newspapers that will either go under or consolidate? Would the North Dakota Newspaper Association be kind of a marriage counselor? Could you go out and find a partner or help with the consolidation issue?
Well, I am certainly willing to counsel any pending marriages out there. I think that, you know, that is something that you know, I think can be a benefit for a lot of different circumstances for community papers. Working with closely with neighbors, whether that means coming together under common ownership or some other kind of collaborative arrangement, I think that can be beneficial and really ensure the future and longevity of our papers. And I, you know, I'm relatively new here at my job, but I think that's one of the things that I'm hoping to learn more and more about is where are those opportunities to really work, you know, cohesively, you know, together, even just neighbor to neighbor, but also on a statewide basis to, you know, make sure that we're making, you know, we're embracing every opportunity to work together in a way that's beneficial to us all. And also looking ahead to the future, you know, we've got some papers where their owners are maybe looking to retire in the next few years. And I think those are conversations that should be had that, you know, what are your plans and how can we make them happen? And we do have folks out there who are up and coming journalists who are eager to tackle some of these issues too. And, you know, maybe take the wheel. And so I think those are unions that I would love to be a part of assisting and exploring too.
Sarah Elmquist Squires is the Executive Director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Sarah, thanks for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Keeping secrets tethers us to the past.
There are a lot of reasons why I lie about that part of my life.
And sometimes keeps us from stepping into the future.
I've not told anyone because I'm afraid of what might happen.
The psychological costs of secret keeping. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 18th. Arikara, or Sanis, as called by its people, is part of the Caddoan language family, a group of languages that comes from the Caddo dialect, which is over 3,000 years old. It's made up of languages spoken around the Missouri and Mississippi River valleys. Apart from Arikara, there are four other distinct Caddoan languages: Caddo, Wichita, Kitsai, and Pawnee. Unfortunately, Kitsai and Wichita are both extinct, although final native Wichita speaker Doris McLemore left recorded language materials. Caddo has 25 speakers, and Pawnee and Arikara both have 10. It's amazing so few speakers remain, considering the Arikara used to have one of the largest populations on the northern plains, with vibrant farming and hunting traditions. They were made up of villages, organized into bands along the Missouri River, and their people lived and traveled between South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas. It wasn't until European settlers devastated the tribe with smallpox that the language started dying out. The tribe suffered major losses, going from an estimated population of 30,000 to 6,000. The epidemic from 1780 to 1782 reduced the number of villages from 32 to only 2. The neighboring Lakota sabotaged healing efforts with repeated raids, forcing the Arikara to move upriver near the Mandan and Hidatsa, with whom they formed an alliance in the early 1800s to become the three affiliated tribes we know today. This restored some strength in the language, but U.S. policies prohibited traditional practices and separated village and families with dams. This all led to a decline in the language. People have continued to speak it, but the fluency is declining. Around this date in 2010, the last fluent speaker, Maud Starr, passed away. However, she dedicated her life to teaching young people the language, and her lessons live on today, with some tribal members speaking it on the Fort Berthold Reservation. Today there are efforts to revitalize indigenous languages. In 2016, the MHA Language Project offered a workshop that brought together teachers and learners. In 2014, the Arikara Cultural Center worked to develop an app that teaches kids the language through fun games. And Yvonne Howard Fox stands strong as the most knowledgeable person about the Sanis. She worked with the Sanis Cultural Society and created a book by combining information from the North Dakota State Historical Society files, elders, and other resources. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or the stream, however you listen, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, the state's nonprofit community was shaken by the news last week that after a century of helping, Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota was shutting down. The announcement came from the agency's president and CEO, Bob Otterson, and on our show tomorrow, we'll talk with Otterson about the circumstances that affected the employment of almost 300 people. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.